You're listening to Podnosis, the pulse of the healthcare industry. I'm Anastasia Gliadkovskaya. Though AI is dominating conversations in healthcare today, many questions remain. Do clinicians understand and trust AI tools? To what extent are algorithms accurate and free from bias? What guardrails are there to protect patient privacy? I was recently at the annual South by Southwest conference in Austin, where pretty much every healthcare panel inevitably ended up on the subject of AI, whether intentionally or not. I attended many sessions, but without a doubt, the one that I saw draw the largest crowd was a panel focused on the future of AI in healthcare. Clinicians and data science experts discussed what it would take to move AI from high potential to high impact. At the end, the audience had 15 minutes to ask questions, though it easily could have gone on longer. After the session, I caught up with two of the panelists, American Medical Association President Jesse Ehrenfeld and Claire Noverall, co-founder and chief medical officer at Ada Health. Here are those conversations.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Open Source Imaging Consortium Data Repository.
I am not.
It was like a collaborative with Microsoft and PwC. They're collecting de-identified medical imaging, like scans, sure, to predict the progression of a rare disease. Oh. And something that they've told me in the past is that it's difficult to get providers to share that kind of data. Like, providers are hesitant around sharing it to train algorithms and that sort of thing. Like, how, what's been your experience? How do you think about the need for that type of collaboration?
There's a need, and one challenge is there are many consortium, many centers, many industry players that are all trying to do the same thing. And it makes it really challenging to actually understand the efficacy of a given tool if you use consortium A's image repository versus consortium B's. If there was some framework where that problem was solved, pick your space, voice scribing, image recognition, diabetic retinopathy, where we thought we really had ground truth in a data set that wasn't biased, that was representative, that would be really helpful. It doesn't exist. Could somebody build that? Maybe. Is there a role for the federal government to take that on? I don't know. But as the FDA figures out their regulatory framework for tools, you know, knowing what those tools are benchmarked against is going to be really important for professionals to understand how well they work, as well as for patients. And there, if you look at the 16 consortiums, Mark's got one, there's others out there that are trying to navigate this space. I think the question that you ask foundationally, what are these things being tested against, is a really important one, and how do we get data into those systems? I think there's been concern around how data is getting monetized. There's been some pretty negative press when patient data is sold without patients' explicit consent. So there's a lot to be sorted out as we solve this problem of having data repositories that can truly allow us to not just develop, but also benchmark these tools.
Got it. That's really helpful. And that kind of leads into my next question. In terms of, while the system is still siloed, all these point solutions, say a health organization is implementing an AI tool, how should they think about collecting data on how it's impacting patient safety or just user feedback?
Yeah, so it is really easy, and I saw this in several of the health systems I've worked. You know, it's really easy to build an algorithm, to build clinical decision support pop-up to remind me to do a thing. It is very challenging, and most institutions don't have, stamina's not the right word, commitment's not quite it, but things get built and forgotten about. And then they just run forever. And we can't allow that to happen, particularly when things change or an algorithm evolves or no longer works. I built software, I deployed software, and it ran fine. And unless you are very intentional about monitoring the performance of these tools over time, they degrade. We had a lab system change, and they changed the label on a glucose value in one system, and it broke everything they built, and nobody realized it for 3 weeks, right? And those examples happen all of the time in the pretty routine state-of-the-art clinical decision support development space that's not even AI. Imagine this problem extending across AI tools. There has to be an intentionality and some diligence in making sure that we have an understanding of how these tools are folding up over time as they're deployed in the real world.
Do you think that's on the provider's internal tech team or that's on the company that's providing that product?
I think it depends on who creates the tool. Most of these tools, their performance is going to be shaped by the conditions of deployment, and that is often something that in many cases the companies aren't going to have control over how it plays on.
Got it.
But it takes a lot of resources to do that, right?
Yeah.
It takes a ton of time and money and energy to deploy something, and then to just do the work to understand how it's actually playing out is almost as resource intensive.
It sounds like you're saying a lot of these tools that are being deployed ultimately aren't effective long term because these things aren't being tracked.
I don't think we know. And nothing is like worse than having pop-ups or alerts that are meaningless. It drives clinicians crazy.
Right.
We have too much of that already. Mm-hmm. I remember when we switched electronic health record vendors at an institution where I used to work, we cataloged. There were thousands of rules firing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had cataloged it. Nobody really knew all the things that were going on until we were trying to figure out, well, what do we actually need to rebuild or carry forward? And there's all this stuff that just didn't make sense, but nobody had obviously done their work.
I'm just wondering, like with AI tools that help with clinical decision making, is there a concern, or do you have a concern about skill atrophy? I've heard this described, like there's maybe physicians lose some of their own skill sets.
I don't. At the end of the day, there will always be a moment when the power might go off and my ventilator might work or the computer system will go down. And we need to account for those things. We need to plan for those things. But to not benefit from what these tools can do to make systems more resilient and more reliable, mm-hmm. I think would be a mistake.
My last question is, how do you think providers should be broaching this conversation of, here's how I use AI in my practice, here's how it's going to affect you? I assume younger patients are more comfortable with those conversations, but a lot might be super distrusting of those technologies. How should a provider start bringing that up? Should there be a policy that's just handed as a paper to a patient, or yeah, that should be in a visit?
Piece of paper they won't read.
Yeah.
I think it's a space where we don't really know what the best practice ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there should be some transparency. If we're sharing data and it's going somewhere to a third party, there are probably circumstances where that ought to be shared with the patient so that they know that. If somebody is listening to a conversation, whether that's a virtual scribe in another country, down the hallway, or AI, you should probably let the patient know that, so that they have an understanding and agree to allow those tools to be used. But I don't think that there's a clear set of best practices. I think it's a space where we have more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
Next, I chatted with Claire Noverall, co-founder and chief medical officer at Ada Health, to get her insights on the future of AI in healthcare. Here's our conversation.
What has been your experience getting hospitals and health systems to feel comfortable maybe sharing their data? I don't know if that's something you do, but something I've covered in the past is there's this medical imaging consortium, and they've said that it's been difficult to get health systems to share de-identified scans for this, to build up this repository, because there's concerns about privacy, but they're also maybe a little protective of their data. Like, what has been your experience?
Yes, it's not a big problem for us because we gather information from the patient, with the patient's own consent. So if you're using the ADA assessment to access healthcare within your healthcare system or plan, we can pull data from the electronic health record if we've done that integration, because the health system wants us to do it. So they want us to be able to pull data with the patient's consent into their health profile so that we have that background information and can use it. But that's not necessary, actually, because you start with assessment and you'll tell it your age and sense, this answer some questions about your health history, and then what is currently bothering you, why you're seeking care, and then the questions come one after another, the most relevant question each time, given the information you've shared so far, to help differentiate what may be going on and how urgent it is and what type of care option would be appropriate. So we are not pulling masses of data in from our systems in order to perform the assessment. It's in patient-led assessment and patient-entered data.
Okay. And then what is the use case then for your collaboration with the health system, putting that data into the EHR?
With that first point of contact for the patient in the digital front doors, for example, in the patient member area in the patient portal, if you log in, if you're a member of a particular health system and you log in the patient portal, maybe you want to book an appointment with, let's say, a primary care physician, and that system will direct me towards the ADA assessment, which it's usually co-branded with the health system's branding and ADAs, maybe fully white labeled, but in most cases it's co-branded. And basically you would then be directed towards there to perform an assessment before you're directed to appropriate care options. And after the assessment, some people will decide, based on the assessment outputs and the information provided, I actually think I can self-manage this. So if you've got a respiratory problem, acute respiratory infection, and it's this most likely viral and self-limiting, and it gives you some information as a patient about what you can do next and why it's unlikely to need to be seen by a physician, with some sort of safety netting advice, then many people will choose actually to self-manage. But there is the information that if this gets worse, if you get more symptoms, then come back and seek care. Mm-hmm. And for other conditions, it'll differentiate. So people will be guided towards often a range of options that are appropriate given the information that they share. So it's doing the triage, it's assessing the urgency, it's assessing the risk, assessing what's likely going on, and therefore what options are likely appropriate, and giving you usually a choice. And some systems that we partner with will then filter that for availability and distance, so that basically you're covered by your insurance. So in addition to the clinical filter, then there's the kind of convenience side and the is this available? What's the wait time? Is this covered for you? And so we work with the clinicians within those partner systems to map the outcomes of ADA's assessment to care options within their system. So it's very aligned with their care protocols and care pathways. And often they'll be looking, if it's an integrated system, it's like a payer and provider, they'll be looking to navigate people away from unnecessary care and towards more cost-effective care options that may be away from in-person primary care visits to a telehealth visit or a nurse chat option, away from unnecessary ER visits to a primary care visit. But also we can help identify the appropriate specialist, and some health systems want to do that and actually get you to the more appropriate specialist first time rather than navigating through to the wrong one once or more times.
How does each system measure the accuracy of this direction, like the recommended care pathway? How do you measure that it was accurate in the end?
Yeah. So that's one thing, is obviously having a system that's clinically robust, and then that connection to the care pathway, the mapping to the care pathways that fits with their protocols and pathways. Closing that loop, actually seeing, did patients who went to that care, was it appropriate for that care? Yeah. That's where some of the complexity of getting access to the health data comes in and makes it difficult to do that at very significant scale. So we have done that at a smaller scale in some instances through research partnerships with those customers. So where we basically have a system in place where the doctors will actually tag, was this appropriate referral? And then we can go through and review and see if there are any areas where maybe we want to tweak and improve those pathways. But we tend to do those on a smaller scale because you need all this ethical approval, and you need the doctors to actually then sort of tag. It's not like we're getting all the records sent to us so that we can go through and actually verify that. So we do it, but it's not en masse and for every assessment. It's really done in a kind of carefully managed research partnership with those clients.
And as she was giving an example of directing underrepresented or marginalized patient groups to care, like, for example, LGBTQ health, that's something I cover, or just more rare diseases.
Yes. So one thing we do see is that a lot of ADA users are younger, not all. When you're integrated into the patient portal for these systems, then you get a really wide range of ages. But especially for the consumer app, it skews to younger populations. Under 30 is probably a large percentage. And they'll often use ADA for things that are maybe embarrassing or stigmatized, and it's difficult to. It's a lot of, I think almost 10% of assessments are sexual health related in some way. So things that it's that bit harder, it's just that extra hurdle before going and speaking to the physician about it. People will use ADA for that. And since some of these things are something that you can actually, get an over-the-counter treatment, or you can, there are easy and accessible services for treatment if, for instance, you have an STI, then having tools like this and easily then navigate you so that you can then treat without having to even go and see a doctor in person can really make the difference between somebody getting diagnosed and treated or not. So yes, we are members of something called the HIV Coalition, which was set up by an organization called the Health Action Alliance and partnered with the White House, and every year on National AIDS Day. We go and all we convene several times a year. We always go there to Washington, D.C. and then discuss sort of the work that we're doing in that space, because we have a large percentage of assessments in the sexual health space, and we are looking at how we can help more people at risk get onto HIV PrEP. So if you're at risk, then pre-exposure prophylaxis. If you could benefit, I should say, it's probably better to say, if you could benefit from this preventive therapy, then helping people recognize that and getting them onto the right option for them as early as possible. So there are things we do in that space. And I would say women's health, it's another area where there's a lot of under-recognized and under-diagnosed problems. So yeah. Endometriosis is an example, actually very common. I think estimates are around 1 in 10 women of reproductive age, and it's so often not recognized, vague symptoms, women go years without a diagnosis. Maybe the first, maybe they don't get a diagnosis until they're trying to have children and they can't, and yeah. Then after a number of investigations, and we flag that as a likely condition causing women's symptoms in a lot of uses. We've had a lot of people contact us to say that have problems for years, that have been navigating around the system, and then AIDA suggested endometriosis, and they've since seen their primary care physician or their obstetrician, and they've been or gynecologists, and they've been investigated, and it's been confirmed. Menopause is another one, because this has been brushed under the carpet for ever, and it's such a large percentage of women at any one time, and women in the workforce, and it's overlooked and ignored, and people don't even realize certain symptoms are caused by that and can be managed. And that's another one that we help to flag. So I think there are so many areas actually where it hasn't had the attention that it deserves, this particular, the conditions haven't had the attention they deserve. Maybe they're being more recognized now. And we feel that a system like ours that can surface these things so that you can then seek the right care is really helpful.
And are there other stakeholders you're planning on working with besides health systems? I don't know if insurance companies.
Yes, big health plans. So health systems, and our sweet spot when we work with health systems, we can work with any large health system. Usually they're larger health systems because there's an effort in all the sort of integration and the deployment and the mapping work and so forth. So they tend to be our main customers. But often they're payer providers, so they're providing the care and they want people to get to the very best care options, but also in a cost-effective way, because it's an integrated system and they're looking. So that's a kind of, it's not the only type of system, but it's a sweet spot. And then also that extends to health plans, who, of course, looking to get people to appropriate care as efficiently as possible and avoid accessing unnecessary, expensive care, getting you to the most appropriate and cost-effective care option. And always there's a wish to improve the patient experience, patient engagement, so whoever the partner is.
Yeah.
And then we also work with life science companies, I think I mentioned that. So that is usually where there is a sort of path to diagnosis and treatment that's not working as efficiently as would be ideal for the patient and the system in general. So, and that can be a rare disease. We have a number of rare disease partnerships. It can be more common diseases, but where there are delays in diagnosis and treatment. And certainly for some of these rare diseases, getting on a correct diagnosis and onto treatment can be life-saving, can be life-changing, can be life-saving to get onto the right treatment earlier. And there are just so many patients for whom that journey takes years and takes way longer than it should. And that's a real opportunity for industry who want to get more people onto their treatments earlier and better outcomes, and at the same time for the patient. And so we think that's a really nice place to work in addition, where we can actually, we make sure that we have those conditions covered in our system, that it's working well for those systems, and then that we're connecting people where that those conditions are flagged as potential cause of their symptoms into the right care options and the next steps in that pathway. Because ultimately the diagnosis comes from a clinician, there'll often be investigations.
Yeah.
They would need to then decide on and prescribe a treatment, and that's all completely independent of our offering. But we can connect people to the clinicians who are knowledgeable and well and qualified in that area and able to take those next steps. So we do that as a front-end piece. So we work with, we have a consumer app, but ultimately we then work with big health systems, with payers, government payers, health plans, and with the pharmaceutical industry.
Thank you for listening to Podnosis. You can find out more about this topic in our show notes at fiercehealthcare.com. Look for podcasts. And don't forget to tune in every Wednesday morning to Podnosis, where healthcare is our beat.